thanks. So thanks to all of you for sticking around for the last talk of the day. The title of my talk is Echoes of Entanglement from Quantum Metrology to Scrambling. This is essentially a talk about going back in time, which I sometimes wish I could do. Maybe some of you do. Wish you could go back, undo something you said or did, and wish you hadn't. And I've more or less given up on doing this in everyday life. But I still have this hope that in some well-controlled system that I can build in my lab, this is something that we might be able to do in that small and controlled world, where essentially going back in time means switching the sign of my Hamiltonian. Why might you like to do that? There are a couple of reasons that I'll talk about. One is maybe to learn something about my system, right? So if rather than going straight back in time, I have some small perturbation along the way, how closely that system comes back to its initial state might tell me something about, say, how chaotic the system is. This is an idea known as the Loschmidt echo. On the flip side of that, if I have a system I understand very well, then maybe I can actually use it as a very good sensor of some perturbations. If I ask the question, does it come back to its initial state or not? So these will be the two motivations I'll have in mind. And all of this you can think about, you know, in a very classical picture, but I'll be particularly interested in asking, thinking about systems where many particle entanglement plays a role. And I'll also be sure to address my biggest fear, the problem that keeps me up at night, which is, you know, this is all well and good if I really have a perfectly closed quantum system. I can flip the sign of my Hamiltonian. But one thing I'll never be able to reverse is dissipation. And so in some realistic physical system, is this concept of time reversal still something useful? So my model system for asking these questions is the one I've sketched here, a system of cold atoms in an optical cavity. And so those atoms have some internal states that I'll represent by a spin. And there are a couple of nice things about this model system. So this will give us a way of having interactions that are actually easy to switch on and off and control the sign of. So in particular, I'll be talking about the situation where one has interactions mediated by light. And it will be a nice model system for having a good quantitative understanding of the interaction to dissipation ratio. And a last rather unique feature of this system is that the interactions are inherently being mediated by light, inherently non-local, which turns out to be a nice property for a couple of reasons. It gives a natural way of entangling atoms sort of en masse, which is of interest in applications to making entangled states that are useful for precision measurements. And it's also suggests some intriguing connections to models that you've heard about, like the Sachdev-Yekutiev model, that are of interest in the context of holographic duality and connections between many-body systems and black holes. So with that in mind, I'll start by giving a little bit more background on these types of on light-mediated spin interactions. And I'll then talk about the focus of my talk will sort of be two examples of echoes, situations where one goes back in time either to enhance a precision measurement or to characterize many-body quantum chaos and scrambling. Okay, so light-mediated interactions. How does one actually make spins interact with light? Well, there are a few different ways one could imagine to do this. I'll show one scheme that I find fairly intuitive to think about, just to give you a concrete picture. So let's say I have some atoms, cold atoms, trapped in an optical cavity and can send in some light from the side. Think of a process where I send in a photon, and that photon can be scattered by some atom into the mode of this cavity, and the atom in its process flips its spin. And if this process is now off-resonant, so it's a virtual process that puts a photon into the cavity, some other atom can rescatter that photon, flipping its spin in a process in a way such that the net process of two spin flips mediated by a photon is resonant. And this gives rise then to some interaction that looks, well, involves the terms I've shown here, either flip two spins up or two spins down or one up, one down. So the net effect is something that looks like an SXI-SXJ interaction between the two spins that scattered the photons. And in principle, with sort of spatial addressing, this is one could use this to have very versatile arbitrary interactions between arbitrary pairs mediated by this cavity mode. Another nice feature of this is that the sort of sign of there's a laser detuning here in this virtual process, the sign of which controls the sign of the interaction. So there's a very simple way to switch this from a ferromagnetic to an anti-ferromagnetic interaction. And the last thing you might ask about this is a cavity where there's, the photons eventually could leak away. So can this interaction be coherent? And well, that will depend on the properties of the cavity. And in particular, if one wants to study very coherent non-local interactions, one would like to be in a regime where that coupling of the atoms to the light is strong compared to the characteristic decay rates associated with spontaneous emission or leakage through the cavity mirror. So this is, we'd like to be able to realize all these features in our lab, and we've been building a system to do that. And so essentially, what are the sort of parameters that we need for that? Well, to get very strong coupling, we need the light to be very tightly focused, ideally to an area not much larger than the atomic cross-section. We can also win by having very good mirrors. And that defines a figure of merit that I'll call the cooperativity, which we'd like to be much larger than 1. That'll also equivalently be our ratio of coupling to decay rates. At the same time, if we want to be able to control these interactions, we need to be able to send in light from the side. So we don't want to get this strong coupling by just making a tiny little box that we don't have optical access to. And so that dictates a rather unusual design, which is something where we essentially have two mirrors that are separated by almost twice the radius of curvature. If it were exactly twice the radius of curvature, the light would come to a point very tightly focused at the center. And the downside would be that it would be basically impossible to align, because any small tilt would leave us without a stable cavity mode. So we back off from that just a little bit, a few microns, and get something where we still have the light tightly focused. And what that looks like then is something like this. So here's really two macroscopic mirrors, 5 centimeters apart, but we align them to microradian precision to be able to have the mode come to a point in the center. And so in the lab, that means a vacuum chamber with some nice positioning stages inside. And if you fine-tune the length to get that mode to come more and more to a point, this figure of merit starts to skyrocket. And okay, so in our lab, this is around 50, which is much, much larger than 1, as we had hoped. And so that's kind of current status of what this looks like. Just loading some cold atoms in there. If you look from the side, you see your usual magneto-optical trap. If you look from the end, you can sort of see them scattering into various cavity modes as I scan this. Probably they're interacting in some way. My graduate students are hard at work getting the interactions well controlled. So I won't show you data from this system, but we already know, I'll tell you a little bit more about what we know from past experience in terms of how these atoms can interact and what one expects to see. So I'll focus actually on kind of a simple limit. I told you one can, in principle, get arbitrary interactions between pairs of spins. If we address them all uniformly, illuminate them uniformly, there's a simple limit where the interaction is an all-to-all interaction. And so in that case, I sort of like this limit because it gives me something I can easily visualize. In particular, I'll visualize this system by a collective spin that's just all the individual ones lined up end to end, which is I can show as in principle a vector on a sphere, or because I have a finite number of spins, kind of a quasi-probability distribution that also shows the quantum fluctuations. And in that all-to-all interacting limit, this Hamiltonian just is quadratic in that, say, the total spin along x. And so what it does is to generate a precession about the x-axis at a rate proportional to x. And if I start with some sort of Gaussian state here, it gets twisted out into a state that is squeezed. And so this is a well-known Hamiltonian called the one-axis twisting Hamiltonian that actually has been realized in a variety of different physical systems, including Bose-Einstein condensates. Christian Gross is in the back, did some beautiful experiments on squeezing in such systems, in ion traps, and also already in cavity QED experiments. So I'll zoom in on just some data from an experiment we did a few years back at MIT. This is showing essentially wasn't exactly the scheme I showed you before, but a similar scheme that gives these twisting dynamics mediated by light. One can kind of rotate these states and look at their noise in various directions and see that they have this elliptical shape you would expect. And one thing that's important to note is that so far, this has been done in a regime where the interaction is not unitary. And in particular, if I look at the shapes of these states that it generates, as they become more squeezed, they're also growing in area. And that's not very surprising, because these data I'm showing were done in a weak coupling regime of cavity QED, where that figure of merit I gave you earlier was about 0.1. OK, so we're very excited that we now have a system where that figure of merit can be orders of magnitude larger. But even in this system, actually, this is already, even in this dissipative regime, something that gives rise to entanglement and useful entanglement as measured by the fact that actually these states can offer a benefit. For instance, if I use the spin the precessing spin as a measure of time, this gives a benefit in an atomic clock. And this is something that it's been exciting to see this method that a few years ago was giving a factor of 3 improvement, now giving a factor of 10 improvement over what can be done without entanglement. And so one thing that I'm actually very interested in is, what are the fundamental limits of how far one can get in this type of quantum enhanced measurement? And how can we get there in practice? So these and numerous other experiments have shown that you can use entanglement to perform a phase measurement to better than 1 over the square root of the number of particles. The fundamental limit, if I have say in how well I can measure time, right, is set by the energy time uncertainty principle that says if I have a state with a maximum uncertainty in energy, I should be able to measure time with a precision that goes as 1 over the total number of particles. This is the Heisenberg limit. And the challenge with that is that this requires a state that has a maximum uncertainty in energy, which is something very exotic, a Schrodinger cat state, right? If I call all spins up alive, all spins down dead, this is what it would take to reach this fundamental Heisenberg limit. Okay, so it might intuitively make sense that it should be hard to make very, very macroscopic cat-type states. And so one question we started to ask is, are there easier alternatives? So first, though, maybe let me just say, what is actually the state of the art in making this type of a state? It actually has been done in ion trap experiments with up to 14 ions. And the way it's been done is actually precisely by this type of a twisting Hamiltonian. I'll just actually show that one more time. So this twisting evolution at first squeezes, but eventually it starts causing some interference effects. And if you let it run long enough, you actually expect to arrive at a state that if I started with a spin pointing towards the front of the sphere, at the end it's in a superposition of pointing to the front and the back of the sphere. Okay, so the challenge with this, if you'd like to scale this up to more macroscopic systems, is that the sort of strength of this twisting scales with the total number of atoms. And so you need a very, very long coherent evolution time. That's one challenge. If you lose a single one of these atoms, the macroscopic superposition will completely decohere. And even to detect this state, one actually needs a parity measurement, which is a very hard thing to do. I need single atom resolution in a large system. So this led us to ask the question, is there a way, so if I want to reach this Heisenberg limit, I need single atom resolution. And quite generally, whenever I do something where I say I'm going to prepare some entangled state and try to detect it, the quality of my detection will actually limit the benefit I'm able to get from that state. So we ask the question, can we actually circumvent the need to directly detect some highly entangled state like this? And in particular, maybe we can go back to this idea I presented of some kind of an echo, right? So rather than thinking my approach should be make an entangled state, perturb it, and then try to measure that perturbed entangled state, how about making an entangled state by some letting it evolve, a system evolve under some Hamiltonian, perturbing it a bit, and then trying to reverse the evolution and see whether it comes back to the initial state. This is inspired by this idea of the Loschmidt echo as a diagnostic of chaos. But what if we just take actually this simple interaction that I know how to make and run it forwards and backwards in time? If I do that precisely, then I start with this Gaussian state here. I should come back to the same Gaussian state. But if instead I have some small perturbation, and in this case it's a rotation about the y-axis, it's so small you can barely see it, but that's what's happening from here to here, then I won't come back exactly to the initial state. And in particular, something very interesting happens here. So what happens is if I have a slight rotation about y that lifts the state up a little bit, then when I try to kind of reverse my evolution, untwist the thing, then that very small displacement vertically gets amplified actually into a very large phase rotation that is easy to detect. So I can show that a little bit more schematically here in case it's hard to visualize on the sphere, right? I have this twisting, that's these blue arrows. Then I perturb the state a little bit, shifting it up here, and then that small perturbation gets amplified by my untwisting into a very, very large displacement that should be easy to see. If you ask the question, what does that do in terms of the metrological benefit, it's actually quite exciting. So we, as a starting point, let me just say the blue curve here is imagining that we do this twisting evolution, and we just ask the question, what is the intrinsic potential of the state that we've prepared as a function of how long we twisted it? And that actually, if you go for a very, very long time, right, you make this maximally entangled state. That's this point here where it's saying it's all the way at the Heisenberg limit. The line down here would be the best you could do without entanglement. But the interesting thing you see is actually already long before there, in fact, the factor root n earlier, the metrological benefit is almost at that Heisenberg limit. It's a factor of less than a factor of 2 away. So that suggests maybe there's something that's easier to do that doesn't involve this very long evolution time. And in fact, what one sees if one does this echo with an evolution time that's root n times shorter than what it would take to make this maximally entangled state, one already achieves almost that fundamental limit, the factor of root e away. So Heisenberg scaling and phase sensitivity. Okay, that's because we're amplifying this perturbation. The state that actually reaches that Heisenberg scaling, it's something that is actually already non-Gaussian. It's starting to twist around the sphere. And so it does better than one could do even with perfect detection with a squeeze state. But beyond that, the benefit of this echo is that we don't need to detect with single atom resolution, a measurement that's sort of on the order of the quantum fluctuations of the unentangled state, square root of n uncertainty and atom number, suffices to benefit from this very, very narrow entangled state. And so this was exciting, and we asked one more question, which is, well, this is all ideal, perfect coherent evolution. What if I have some realistic system with some dissipation? And the bottom line is, even in that case, the dissipation, depending how strong it is, might prevent you from getting all the way to this limit. But one can get, even in a very dissipative system, significant metrological gain. And one can do it without needing to detect perfectly the very small quantum noise after this twisting that entangles the state. So with very low resolution detection, one can perform a measurement well beyond the standard quantum limit. Okay, and so with, you know, seeing that that should work in principle, it was fairly easy to convince our colleagues down the hall in Mark Kasevich's group to do an experiment that basically employed this principle of not just entangling a state and detecting it, but actually using interactions to facilitate the state detection. And in this case, they were able to show almost a factor of 10 in squeezing with a measurement that could only barely resolve the quantum noise of an unentangled state. Okay, so that's in a system that's still fairly dissipative. We, thinking ahead to our dreams with our nice strong coupling cavity, there are other types of variants of this sort of echo scheme that one could imagine implementing. And things we've thought about are, for instance, using the non-local interaction to couple a single spin with an ensemble, say map a superposition of the single spin onto a superposition of many atoms, and then map, use that for quantum enhanced sensing, and then map the information back onto my control spin. This is inspired by work by Paula and Misha, who are maybe the audience. We've also thought about, you know, is there a way to harness some chaotic dynamics in this system to enhance, to actually harness that for quantum enhanced measurements. And so we were kind of thinking about these ideas, and right around that time, I received an email from my now collaborator, Brian Swingle, which got me very excited because it had a lot of the same buzzwords in it. So he said he wanted a way to reverse time. He was looking for some system where one could evolve under a Hamiltonian, evolve under minus the Hamiltonian, have some kind of control qubit. And he said the reason he was interested in this was diagnosing chaos. So I said, great, we've been thinking about this. This sounds a lot like our dreams for our cavity QED system. Why do you want to do these things? And he told me about this problem of scrambling that you've now heard about in a few different talks. Right, so the question was, let's say I have some many-body system, and I perturb a particular qubit. How long does it take for the effect of that perturbation to propagate over the entire system and for that this local bit to become entangled with all degrees of freedom in the system, or in other words, scrambled? So this is a concept that first came out of thinking about the information problem in black holes. And the connection between the black hole and the quantum many-body system is this holographic principle that relates certain strongly correlated field theories in d spatial dimensions to a classical field theory in one extra dimension with the geometry of a black hole in anti de Sitter space. And in my sort of, at least my simplistic experimentalist picture of this is that the extra dimension is coming about from the need to describe the structure of entanglement in the quantum system by appropriately renormalizing out, renormalizing the degrees of freedom in a way that preserves that structure. So this correspondence suggests that it's an interesting question to ask, among other things, can we actually realize in tabletop experiments systems that are holographically dual to black holes? You've heard some talks writing down some models on paper, which is you know, very exciting, being able to actually analyze some models and analyze their scrambling dynamics and use that as a way of determining which models might be dual to black holes. And so we asked, you know, you could ask the same question in the lab. Maybe I can't realize precisely the model that one can analyze on paper, but can I in the lab, by measuring the way the information scrambles, identify what might be candidate systems for being dual to black holes? So the idea is that a candidate would be something that scrambles as fast as a black hole, which is conjectured to be the fastest scrambler in nature. Just to review what I think hopefully probably by now you've heard a couple of times, in terms of the sort of relaxation time for local observables, which is just set by the inverse 1 over 2 pi times the temperature, the scrambling time in the black hole, so the time for a perturbation to really spread over the all degrees of freedom scales as that relaxation time times the log of the entropy. And there's an intuition for sort of why that's the fastest that information should be able to spread over all degrees of freedom. And to get that intuition, it's useful to think about the system of entropy S. I've written right, this double script S here is my entropy, to think of that as just a system of S qubits, right? That will have entropy S. And if they interact on some characteristic timescale tau, then, and I allow only pairwise interactions, then the fastest that I can get information to spread from one over the entire system is if I do something like randomly connect them in one time step of length tau, and then reconnect them randomly again and again. And if I do that, then the total number of time steps I'll need will be log 2 of the entropy. And so that's so I can get some intuition for where this logarithmic scaling is coming from. And intriguingly, this type of random non-local interaction seems sort of unnatural, but is not so different from the type of thing one might be able to implement in the cavity. Okay, so the intuition then is that as a candidate system for displaying this fast scrambling, we should look to something that's chaotic. And you've heard a few times that an appropriate measure of chaos for a quantum many-body system is to ask about the growth of commutators. So in particular, I'll start by considering something like a spin chain, right? And if I consider two simple operators, maybe spin rotations, I'll call them V and W. If they're acting on different spins, then if I perform them at equal times, those operations commute. But generically now, if I consider the rotation of this spin at one time and some rotation W of this spin at a later time, then, so W is the Heisenberg operator at some later time, then those might fail to commute because there are interactions that will allow the influence, allow this perturbation here to influence what's happening over here. And so the question then, or our diagnostic of chaos, is how fast does the commutator between V and W at this later time grow as a function of time due to interactions in the system? Okay, so right. So to measure this, what you'd like to do is to measure the decay of this four-point function that you've seen. And one way to think about this is essentially what one wants to do is to compare two possible kind of pathways. One, where I have this operation V, and at a later time, this operation W, in other words, I have the operation V, I let my system interact for some time T, then I perform the operation W, versus I let the system interact for a time T, perform the operation W, and then actually go back in time and apply the operation V. And what I'd like to see is what's the overlap between the final state in those two cases. Or to put it another way, you can think of this upper branch as being a situation where I gave this talk with all of the slides in exactly the right order, and you followed and understood, and you're happy. And the bottom one is where I forgot a crucial piece of information early in the talk. I skipped a slide. You're confused by the end. And if I actually forgot a slide just, you know, two slides ago and fixed it, then that might be okay. You might not be too confused. But if I forgot the very first slide and only fixed it at the very end, you would be very confused. And so what I want to do is measure basically the overlap between sort of the happy version of you and the confused version of you and see how that decays as a function of the time elapsed. Okay. So two tools needed for this are some way of reversing time and some sort of many-body interferometry, right? Because really what I'm doing here is I'm measuring the overlap between two different many-body quantum states. Okay. And you've heard of some schemes, for instance, in NMR, we heard today from Paula, for actually measuring this out-of-time correlator for certain types of operators. But one question that we asked is, what's sort of a very generic way of doing this? And to form this type of interferometer, we said, well, what we'd like is some kind of a control qubit that controls basically whether or not this operation V happens at the beginning of our sequence here, and conditioned on the state of some control qubit. So we would either perform this operation or not. Later, we would flip the control qubit and perform it on the lower branch. OK. So this is kind of conceptually very generic. And you could imagine this, for instance, being in a spin chain, having some local control, some nearest neighbor interaction that controls whether or not this particular spin here is flipped before we let the system interact. And then later, unconditionally, we flip a spin over here, let's say. Or what I will actually show some simulations of is a case where my operations are actually not local but global, and this will give me a way to actually kind of visualize what's happening in this block sphere picture I was showing you before. So it could either be some local spin flip, or I'll think about the case where it's some small but global rotations. Okay, right. So to have some model where we can sort of visualize what's going on in measuring this out of time correlator, I'll show you on the next slide, actually, a model that's a chaotic model in the block sphere. But just to say, you know, how could one actually imagine implementing this? The physical system you could have in mind would be, again, something where there's a control qubit here that controls whether or not there's a photon in the cavity that rotates all of these ensemble spins by some small amount. And one could also make this equally well a local controlled operation. But I'll focus on the global case. So the model, it's a well-studied actually model for chaos that's an analog of a classical, sort of a kicked top. So in particular, what does that mean? So the top is some spin precession, which happens for some time. And then periodically, there's a kick, which is precisely this twisting Hamiltonian. So alternating between these two gives rise to a chaotic system. And from sort of past studies of this model, one knows that in the appropriate parameter regime, one actually expects after log n kicks, so log n sort of Floquet periods here, this initial state to spread over the entire sphere. And so now we ask the question, well, what happens actually if we sort of simulate the out-of-time correlator for these two simple operations being small rotations about the z-axis by an angle that's sort of on the order of the quantum noise of the initial state? OK. So but before actually asking the question about this four-point function, we said, well, what happens, first of all, if we just look at a simple time-ordered correlation function? So that's what I call g here. And this is showing the decay of that time-ordered correlation function for various different atom numbers. So darker is a larger and larger system. And OK, so it decays in some way. It looks like maybe it decays a little bit faster the more atoms one has. If one looks now at the out-of-time-order correlation function, the behavior is actually noticeably different. And in particular, one sees a decay that happens slower and slower the larger the system. And this matches this notion that this decay time should scale with the system, should scale with the system size in some way, and that we need to scramble with all degrees of freedom. And as the number of degrees of freedom grows, the decay time should become longer. OK, so that kind of matches our expectations. And in particular, if one looks at the scaling with n, I haven't rigorously done a fit to these, but it looks roughly consistent with something that scales as the log of the number of atoms. And that matches, in some sense, this picture of the spreading on the block sphere taking a time that goes as log n. So the spreading over the full sphere taking a time that goes as log n. I can think of that really kind of in a semi-classical picture as the fact that the size of the sphere compared to the size of the initial quantum fluctuations is a factor of n larger. So one question, just to see whether you all are following me, I can ask is this potentially a fast scrambler or not? Is anybody following?
No, it's not as well
It's not a black hole. Okay, yeah. So the yeah, what was the temperature? So actually, yeah, I didn't really start in a thermal state. I actually started in just all spins pointing along one direction. But so that's maybe not even so well defined. So there are a couple of questions there that make it hard even to say, right, how should I define this fast scrambling bound? Aside from that, though, actually, one point I want to make is I sort of suggestively put this log here. But this is, in this collective spin model, my Hilbert space is not actually 2 to the n dimensional. It's n dimensional. So my entropy, if I say the entropy is sort of set by the size of this space that's this block sphere of collective spin, is only log n. And so I don't want to make any, I don't want to misleadingly make the claim here that this is even showing this log entropy scaling. The bound, if there is one, I would expect to be something like log log n. Okay, so just to be clear that I'm not claiming to be showing a fast scrambler, but I think we have this gives some nice intuition for what one could expect to measure in sort of a realistic experimental system. Actually, so could one expect to measure it? I haven't said anything yet about dissipation. So one can ask, you know, how good, how coherent do the interactions need to be for us even to observe this time scale? And one can then, you know, essentially saying that the time one needs is order log n, and knowing the strength of each kick to be in this chaotic regime, one can place a bound on the cavity quality one would need to see this. And it is, in fact, something that is not easy, but on the order of our experimental parameters. So that's sort of the hand-waving argument. And if one actually models this, including dissipation at a single atom cooperativity of 100, one sees that on this time scale, the dashes are the dissipative version, at least qualitatively. The behavior looks quite similar, and I wish that I could actually see what happens as one makes the system more dissipative, but it actually becomes hard to calculate for 100 spins because one no longer is in this simple Hilbert space of the totally symmetric system. So nevertheless, this looks promising for this being something that one could actually explore experimentally. And so kind of to summarize, I think it's very exciting that this scrambling time is something that is something that we're only recently thinking about in the context of quantum many-body systems, but that really is actually a fundamental time scale that is now becoming accessible in what we could call these designer quantum systems. So I showed you an example of something we can dream of doing in the cavity setting, but you've already, I think, hopefully heard a little bit maybe from Anna Maria Ray about some nice experiments starting to probe these out-of-time correlators in ion Penning traps. There's also been one experiment in NMR simulator. And so this is an exciting new direction of exploration in designer quantum systems. And the key signature that one can actually hope to see, I think, is that what we saw is that there are these time-ordered correlators that also decay in some way. But the out-of-time correlator decays in a way that is scaling, that the time scale is becoming longer and longer with more and more degrees of freedom. And this is something one wouldn't expect from simply dissipation, say. So this is kind of a very characteristic signature of this out-of-time correlator that's measuring scrambling. So I showed an example in a globally interacting model that's easy for us to analyze and to visualize. But what would be particularly exciting is to take this into the direction of non-locally interacting models that these light-mediated interactions are actually quite naturally suited to realizing. And the same kind of approach, I should say, though, is also equally applicable to models, to local models. One physical system that I think is quite exciting for this are Rydberg atoms or Rydberg-dressed atoms in optical lattices, where one can also imagine having qubit-controlled rotations, long-range interactions. And I think Christian promised he'll show one slide on current status in Rydberg dressing and lattices tomorrow morning, so I'm excited to see that. So that concludes my talk. To summarize, I'll just say I've talked about two applications of reversing time, either to characterizing quantum many-body systems, or on the flip side of that, to using a well-controlled many-body system to detect perturbations. And even in realistic quantum systems that one can hope to realize in the lab, whereas time reversal will never be perfect, it looks like it can be good enough. And so with that, I will just thank my students on the cavity QED experiment, collaborators, particularly Brian Swingle, and take any questions.
Thanks, Monica. There was this like dip or resonance in your kicked rotor simulations at like 5 kicks. Do you know what that's from?
A dip or resonance at this.
Like, yeah.
No,
in the OTO.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know what it's from. I think probably one should ask, is that, you know, how generic is that? I mean, this is for some particular initial condition and point in the possible parameter space of the strength of the kick and the strength of the precession.
I mean, it's pretty generic in like system sizes, which is pretty interesting.
Which is interesting, yeah. And so so actually I don't have a simple answer off the top of my head. One could also, in this model, because it's something one can visualize, one could actually look, what does the state look like at that time? And does it tell us something? It's a good question. I don't know the answer.
So suppose what I want to know is not at the end, but in the middle of the evolution, right? After H happened.
Yeah.
Then I put minus H. So my question is, if my H was not perfect, it had a some other perturbation term, but it remained static for H and minus H.
Mm-hmm.
Then what do I, so basically, suppose in the middle I want a cat state. How do I know if I went to a different state rather than a cat state, then if I come back to, you know, similar points?
So I think it depends a little bit what you're trying to do. Or I would say whether you care depends a little bit on what you're trying to do. So, right, if you're thinking of kind of the echo for a quantum enhanced measurement, then what I actually care about is how sensitive is the final state to perturbations that happen in the middle. And I actually, if I can see that I have an enhanced sensitivity to perturbations, I don't actually really care exactly what that final state was. Does that?
Yeah.
Now, if you're asking the question, have I actually simulated the system I want to simulate?
Yeah.
Because I'm using this, you know, to diagnose, quantify chaos in that system.
That's right.
Then you care probably, right? That the Hamiltonian is really the one you thought you had,
yeah.
And so, you know, ideally you'd say you'd like to, at the end, to do some quantum state tomography, let's say, and see whether it's in the state you think it should be. I think part of the beauty of these schemes is that you don't actually need to detect that state in the middle. Oh. So I don't have a simple answer to what one should do to actually, certify that you actually have simulated the Hamiltonian you wanted to. I think that's probably a challenging question. But one can also ask, for instance, how sensitive is this more generally to errors in control, right? Like intuitively you think you're trying to measure chaos, so it should be very sensitive to errors in control. And that's probably true, and there's some thought that's been put into essentially, can one at least kind of normalize out those errors by doing this type of echo for the out-of-time correlator, but also doing, say, an echo with a time-ordered correlator, and by appropriately normalizing the different measurements, it seems that there's some ways to actually minimize the sensitivity to errors in control.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you could comment on the experimental status of this quantum switch.
Yeah, of being able to implement this type of quantum switch. I mean, it's something that we would love to do in the cavity, and we're not there yet, but I think, you know, I showed you, we sort of have all the pieces together. We have the strong coupling cavity. We actually have the optical access to have something like 1 micron resolution, whereas the strongly coupled region is several hundred microns long. And so we're putting together all the pieces that we can, in fact, then hopefully soon locally address one and let it influence the others by this long-range interaction. Other systems, there are other systems where this may be closer to realization. So I briefly touched on Rydberg atoms and an optical lattice. I think that's something where it would be very natural to do this type of, have a Rydberg atom act as a quantum switch that influences one or more atoms around it.
So this model has a mixed phase space, so it has chaotic, non-chaotic regions, and then I would just imagine, like always in quantum mechanics happens, if you want to have some semi-classical picture, we'll average over like everything, chaotic, non-chaotic, and if something decays, usually the slowest exponent, I would assume, dominate the decay, so basically non-chaotic region. So and this model looks like sufficiently simple, so is there any evidence that this object has anything to do with chaos at all?
So, which object? Sorry, the model or this F.
F for this model, because if you have a model which has mixed chaotic and non-chaotic regions.
So I mean, I think so. Something that
will probably dominate
would probably be a good thing to do that I have to admit we haven't done is to look quite more systematically at how this behaves depending where one starts in this kind of phase space of chaotic versus non-chaotic. I mean, so this is something where we did choose the parameters to be in a chaotic region. But I think that what you're now saying is there are some quantum fluctuations, and so.
I just know this model, which Pedram simulated, it has very large, I mean, it's like all
low. Sorry, are you talking about, so there, are you talking about parameter space in terms of I can choose my strength of the kick and the strength of the precession, or
oh, just
fa- or
no,
you're
no,
saying
no.
now
if
on
I
the
look
sphere,
the
there's,
space,
yeah,
there's
yeah,
yeah,
the classical phase space, not,
right, right, right.
It yeah, yeah,
chaotic,
so it has some
non-chaotic.
Regular islands.
And if I
yeah.
think about,
yeah.
Some,
yeah, that's right. And so we chose something where the initial state is somewhere in the chaotic region, but I agree with you're saying the chaotic region doesn't quite cover the, yeah, there's some uncertainty and that doesn't quite cover the entire sphere. There are some regular islands. And so
my understanding was sort of postulated that it describes chaos, but so far I just don't understand why. So if you are very close to classical chaotic point, like single point, yes, this is true. But why people say it's quantum chaos otherwise, at least. I just don't
so in some sense, you would say I actually need to be, well, sorry, it's not just a point. There are large regions
yeah,
that are
chaotic.
Yeah,
but that's what I'm saying.
Right?
So these regions will cover chaotic regions, non-chaotic regions, and it will be like a total mix. And it's.
Yeah, so maybe I can flip it around and say, what would you want to see to sort of establish that it is chaotic? I mean, I think. Yeah, I think, yeah, so. I mean, again, so in terms of this simulation, we started in some region that, in one of the chaotic regions, but I agree there are quantum fluctuations around
then
that.
At least you see
yeah.
that in chaotic regions it decays faster if you're...
But I, so I have to admit, we haven't systematically investigated, you know, depending where one starts, what happens, and I think that's actually would be a great thing to do. We were mostly trying to just... you know, see, for instance, that one does see a distinct behavior for the out-of-time versus time-ordered correlators, yeah.
But this is a quantum question. You don't have a classical initial condition, right?
So yeah, so it's a finite system, right? And we've scaled the size. We've looked at different system sizes.
So how can you fix an initial classical condition? Because I think
but there's, in the from the semi-classical limit, I think it's understood, essentially,
okay.
You know, which regions are chaotic and which are not, yeah.
Do you know these decays are power law or actually exponential, right? So
is it exponential?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so you can see it's actually, this is, does not really look exponential, right? It's more, yeah. It's and that I think is what's actually expected in the sense that, well, the commutator is initially zero, right? And so what does it mean for zero to grow exponentially? Right, so somehow it needs to initiate.
No, but scrambling, yeah. I mean, the way you define the chaos, right, you have to have some intermediate time scale where it grows.
So to sort of define the time scale.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, roughly speaking, when I said that it appears to be growing roughly as log n, we're basically saying, you know, how long does it take for it to decay to roughly half its value, let's say, right? So
yeah, I understand,
it's,
but
it's somewhat, yeah. It's not something that we fit in exponential and look at the time constant. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, let us thank Monica and all the speakers today. Thank you.